From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Under the radar, while the U.S. is engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq and focused on these strange times in Washington politics, U.S. troops are on the ground across northern Africa. A dozen small military bases that we know of, 800 troops alone in the landlocked desert nation of Niger. Four Green Berets lost their lives in an ambush there 2 weeks ago, and now we're paying attention. Those deaths and their handling, have also created a political uproar. This hour on Point, what happened in Niger, and how President Trump is handling and talking about military deaths. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you know American forces were spread out across the northern tier of Africa? And we'll come to it later, but what about the president's handling of these deaths, his depiction of other presidents in the consoling role? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. First today to North Africa and what happened in Niger. Joining me from Washington is Eric Schmidt. He covers defense and national security for the New York Times. Eric, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, October 4th, and here we are in Niger. For our listeners who can't quite place it, think of it as kind of smack dab in the middle of the Sahara Desert, just underneath south of Algeria and Libya. There's a village over by the Mali border. That's the western side. And American troops are doing what when what happens, Eric?
So there's about a dozen Army Special Forces that are out with a contingent of soldiers from Niger. And this is a part of a routine training mission. At least that's what the military said this was going to be, helping to train these indigenous troops how to prepare for counterterrorism operations, how to do patrols in the desert, a number of things that these American Special Forces have been doing for some years now, as you say, quietly. They're into this mission, and they're coming up toward the end of it when all of a sudden they are ambushed by a larger, well-armed force. The Pentagon now believes it's some type of cell from the Islamic State, but there is a mixture of militant groups right around this border area, including Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and they are quickly ambushed by this, and they take casualties. As you mentioned, four Special Forces soldiers are killed, two are wounded. Very quickly, French helicopters are dispatched to help. The French have a large presence in the area, being the former colonial power, and are able to evacuate the dead and wounded. But a lot of questions are being asked here in Washington and at the Africa Command's headquarters in Stuttgart, Germany, of how this happened. This is supposed to be a training mission. They weren't expecting this kind of enemy fire. The Pentagon said last week they'd done reconnaissance missions like this some 29 times in the last few months. But other officials I've spoken to are very dubious about some of this and wondering whether the American forces who led this training exercise had done their homework before they went out.
The Defense Secretary, James Mattis, former general, said a hard fight. This was a very tough fight, he said. We were reading reports that some of them were still in talking with village leaders. Some were out by the pickup trucks. These were not armored pickup trucks. So they were divided when the firing broke out, RPG and small arms. They were vulnerable because they were separated, tried to get back together, pickup trucks being, windows blown out and sounds like fire all over the place. They're returning fire. There was some kind of real exchange here.
Absolutely. Yes, this went on, at least I was told initially, for some half hour or so, this running gun battle, if you will, against a larger force. I was told some of the militants were armed in the backs of pickup trucks with heavy machine guns. As you said, there's some reports of RPGs being fired at the group. In fact, in the casualty count for the Americans, there were the three killed, and then there was a soldier missing. The fourth soldier, his body was recovered a couple days later by the Nigerians, shows that they were separated, and it just kind of shows how surprised they were when this happened.
And this fourth soldier, of course, LaDavid Johnson, whose case has become a kind of a political hot button back here in the States. This is the family that the president ultimately called, and then there's controversy over whether he said, well, he knew what he signed up for, and the family's response to that, whether the president said it, and all that.
That's right.
I think to many Americans, the idea that there are 800 U.S. troops in Niger, and lots of people, I'm sure, can't place that on a map. I had to look to see exactly, you know, how it relates to the countries around it, comes as something of a surprise. I'm reading here that in 2006, just 1% of U.S. commandos sent overseas were deployed in the U.S. Africa Command. Today, that's more than 17% of all U.S. special forces abroad. What is going on in Africa? Why are so many U.S. forces there?
Well, if you look across the continent, there are about 6,000 U.S. personnel spread across the African continent. The bulk of them are in a base in Djibouti called Camp Lamanye, about 4,000 of them.
This is all the way out at the eastern horn of Africa.
That's correct, near Somalia, where we've also heard, you know, there was the big bombings in Mogadishu just over the weekend, the largest in that country's history, carried out by the Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Shabaab. What you have here, Tom, is a number of militant groups that are taking advantage of ungoverned spaces in places like Somalia, in Libya, parts of Niger, Mali, and Chad, that are easy for these groups to operate in. They don't, they can terrorize local communities. It doesn't cost much money for them to operate, and they're getting support either from, you know, Qaeda, larger, wealthier Qaeda affiliates or headquarters, or they're getting guidance, as is the case in Libya from the Islamic State. And so the United States has deployed special forces there, not in large numbers, as you point out, but in smaller numbers, because this has been the approach that both the Obama administration and now the Trump administration has taken to basically carry out these counterterrorism missions in a place like Africa by, with, and through allies. That is, these are the indigenous forces that presumably know the terrain best, they know the languages, and they are the ones that are going to have to be carrying out this fight long term.
I mean, we say small numbers, but 800 in Niger doesn't seem
that
small to me.
So I was surprised by that number, too. And what's happening in Niger is there's already one large drone base there, where the U.S. flies drones, surveillance drones for the region, and they're building a second one in a place called Agadez.
A $50 million new base they're putting in this. This isn't nothing.
Yeah. So this kind of underscores the threat that the United States and its allies feel is in this part of Africa from these disparate number of groups. And we didn't mention Boko Haram, which is another one in that area, the one that's well known for kidnapping some 200 schoolgirls a few years ago. So this is something that this commitment of forces started in the Obama administration. It's been increased quietly under the Trump administration. As we've seen now, casualties have been suffered. There was a Navy SEAL killed in Somalia in May, the first time since Black Hawk Down that there's been a loss of life there. And now this very tragic loss of four special forces officers, quite dramatic in this country of Niger.
I'm reading here from Brigadier General Donald Baldock. This is the chief of U.S. Special Operations Command, Africa, telling African Defense, he's quoting him here, "We are not at war in Africa, but our African partners certainly are, and the U.S. is right in the middle of that." There's an ongoing after-action report being investigated for the Pentagon on what happened there in this village in Niger. What are the questions that linger, Eric, out of this clash that left four Americans dead and two injured, and a number of Nigerian forces dead as well?
Right. And I spoke to General Baldock, who just recently retired from that job, so he's got a little bit of distance, but he knows the terrain very well. And what he said he would expect to see in this investigation is, A, what were the steps that the dozen or so special forces did before they went out? What kind of risk assessment did they do, for instance, checking the intelligence? Because that will drive the so-called force protection model you take. You know, if you're expecting to run into enemy forces, you either may not go to that area, or you're certainly going to go up with, you know, more armored vehicles or heavier armaments. You're also going to be prepared to have air cover, which there were helicopters in the region when this happened, but they weren't right over the mission, so that would drive that. And it would also you'd also have to have medical evacuation capabilities standing by if you thought you were going to be running into trouble. Now,
Eric, I'm reading here, Eric, forgive me, but I'm reading that they were ultimately evacuated by private contractors, which brings to mind, especially in the African context, the sort of cowboy operations.
Well, this is what the command testified to the Senate earlier this year, that they, and this is an improvement over what was happening before, that they are having to rely on private contracted aircraft as well as the French. And I think in this case, there were French aircraft as well that helped evacuate the wounded. But the U.S. just doesn't have the capability on itself in Africa to cover the vast landscape that you've got there. These are huge countries. Niger is twice the size of Texas.
Wow.
And largely desert and very remote and inhospitable area to be operating in. So that's another reason that one of the things they'll be investigating is, did these guys deviate from the protocol of their mission? Did they get a little bit too far forward in what was supposed to be a training mission? Were they diverted somehow? There's different reports. They may have gone after some militants earlier. That may have lured them into an ambush. We really don't know exactly what happened yet, Tom, and so that's why there are a lot of questions still outstanding.
Eric, Americans may think, well, here's this remote country in the middle of the Sahara Desert. What does it matter what happens there? Why is the Pentagon so focused on this?
Well, it matters because you've got these groups, again, like ISIS in Libya, and if you give them a foothold in an ungoverned space, yeah, okay, maybe they're constrained to some desert outpost in the middle of this middle of Libya for now. But if you let them grow, and they have their sights set on attacking Americans or other Westerners, either in North Africa or more likely in Europe, maybe even jumping across the United States, that's the risk that you pose. Principally, it's a threat to U.S. and American, U.S. and other Western interests in the region, but also in Africa, particularly on the North African scene, where it's so easy to hop on a boat or get yourself into the European continent as well from Africa. That's always been the longtime fear, is that this kind of threat in Africa will spread into the continent.
We're going to talk more about it later, but was it odd, just in a couple of seconds here, that the president didn't speak about this until 12 days later, or was that par for the course?
It certainly seemed odd, and it looked like the NSC had actually drafted a statement for him to say. This was actually when they just knew of three killed, and he never issued the statement. So again, questions raised why it took so long.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire but short on time? You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what happened in Niger that left four American Green Berets dead. And in just a few minutes, we'll turn as well to look at how the president has handled those deaths, how other presidents have done that hard work. Eric Schmidt is with us from the New York Times, covers defense and national security. You can join us as well. What do you think about Niger, the deaths there? Were you even aware that there are so many American troops in North Africa, so much activity there? Should the Pentagon, the president, be more open about what we're doing there, about exactly how and why these soldiers died? And, of course, what about the president's response to all this? The ambush was on October 4th. Three were known dead immediately. One, LaDavid Johnson, who now has become famous, or his case a little bit infamous, as there's this controversy about what the president said to his family in that car, where there was also a congresswoman. Did he say, well, he knew what he signed up for? But on October 5th, the president didn't talk about any of this for 12 days. On October 5th, the Pentagon did. This was spokeswoman Dana White. After that ambush, talking to reporters about the deaths of what was understood then to be three Green Berets, at that stage, the fourth was still listed as missing. Here she was.
As many of you have already reported, last night, three U.S. service members and one partner nation member were killed. Two U.S. service members were injured while conducting an advise and assist mission in Niger security forces in southwest Niger. On behalf of everyone on the department and the Secretary of Defense, we extend our deepest condolences and sympathies to the families of the fallen and those injured in this attack.
That was October 5th from the Pentagon, the day after the attack. It would be 12 days before the president would speak of it. And then just this week when he was questioned about it as he stood with Mitch McConnell outside the White House. Eric Schmidt is looking at this with us from the New York Times. Christopher Chivas joins us right now as well, Associate Director of the RAND Corporation's International Security and Defense Policy Center, professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, expert in counterterrorism, national security in North Africa, an area of particular interest to him, author of The French War and Al-Qaeda in Africa. Christopher Chivas in Washington, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
John McCain was asked yesterday whether the administration has been upfront about this attack in Niger, and McCain just said no. He just answered no. Are there important things that we still don't know, Christopher?
I wouldn't know if there are. I mean, you're asking me about the details of the operation here, which I think, I imagine we may learn more as we, as this unfolds. But I mean, I think that there's one thing that I would caution against, which is, going too far in portraying this as, mistakes that were made by the individual soldiers on the ground.
We have not done that. I just want to be very clear. We haven't done that in any way. So I'm not sure what you're speaking about. It's just that McCain said he was asked, do we know everything we should know? And he said no.
Well, if that's what Senator McCain thinks, then I'll be interested to hear, what additional details he wants to put out there.
Could you describe the extent of American emplacements across Africa, North Africa for us at this point? We know about the big base out Djibouti way, but there's a lot more than that. What kind of installations are there now and what kind of personnel?
Well, I mean, I think so we've been talking about this a little bit, and I think as Eric said, so if there are 6,000 roughly forces in Africa as a whole, the vast majority of them are in Djibouti. So you're really talking about, some 2,000 spread across the rest of the continent. And I think it's very, very important to bear in mind here the size of Africa as a whole. You're talking about 2,000 forces that are spread out over a very, very vast and very austere environment. And I think that it's also important to point out that those numbers are dynamic. They change in relation to the security needs of individual countries, potentially on a month-to-month kind of a basis. So it's a dynamic situation. And in the broader context, when you think about the numbers of forces that we have, for example, in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, 2,000 forces is actually quite small.
I was asking about bases and emplacements. Drone facilities, we're building another $50 million one here in Niger. Could you describe what kind of bases we have around the region, large and small?
Well, the largest one, as Eric said, is in Djibouti. We've also discussed the drone base in Niger. And it's important to point out and emphasize, I think, that as of now, at least, that's a surveillance operation, which is intended to look at the smuggling routes that the jihadists use across sort of northeastern Mali, southern Algeria, northern Niger, those routes that go into Libya coming from the coast of West Africa.
I still didn't hear a number. I've seen numbers of scores.
Right.
I've seen specific numbers. Do you not know them?
I'm not aware of the specific number of bases that we have in Africa right now. As I said, it's a dynamic situation. The permanent base that we have in Djibouti is the most important one.
The attackers were described as linked to ISIS. What does that say to you? And people may think, oh, is this directed out of, the Raqqa before it fell or some central command? Or what does it mean to you when you hear that, Christopher?
Well, I mean, what you have in Mali and around that whole region is a number of different sort of smaller extremist groups that have been operating there for several years. They tend to shift their allegiances around every couple of years. And the one that is most suspected of being responsible for this attack in Niger is one that's recently pledged its allegiance to the Islamic State. Now, does that mean that the Islamic State is actually directing their attacks? Absolutely not. This is more of a case where you have a group that's decided that its own fortunes are going to be better served by aligning itself with the broad Islamic State movement. And I think we need to put it in that context in particular. This is really mostly a local group.
We had an American military commander saying this week, we are training, advising, and assisting indigenous armies all over the world, and I anticipate and expect that that will increase, not decrease, in the years to come. It's a dangerous mission. Are we on an upward trajectory in Africa in terms of American activity?
I think it's possible. I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. One is sort of the extent of the extremist threat that exists in Africa, in North Africa and West Africa, and then also, as you mentioned, in Somalia. There have even been reports of some extremism creeping into the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example. So I think there is an increase in extremist activity. And you can expect that to be followed by an increase in, you know, in U.S. military activity. However, you know, you need to put that in context both of the other countries that are active in Africa, the French, of course, being the country that has, you know, committed the most resources to dealing with this problem in North and West Africa. And then, of course, also in the context of U.S. global counterterrorism operations, Africa still has been, in terms of the resources and attention that it receives, in a sort of secondary rank after the Middle East and South Asia.
But plenty of troops right now in austere conditions, as Eric Schmidt says. Christopher Chivas, please stand by. Lots of callers here. James in Valdosta, Georgia. James, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I know as from here in Georgia that we've had National Guard troops deployed in Africa since about 2009. I've had good buddies that recently came back probably less than a year ago that were assisting eliminate Boko Haram and training some troops on those missions. I don't know how much many people are aware of the fact, but as for us here in Georgia, I can certainly say that I've known that we've had National Guard troops, not necessarily regular Army or Navy or military, mm-hmm. but just the National Guard has been called up and deployed into Africa for some time, maybe almost 10 years now.
So no surprise to you, though it's not highly visible to most Americans, but there they go. No declared war, but even National Guard there. But thank you, James. Mike in Omaha, Nebraska. Mike, you're on.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Mike.
Well, what gets me is how oblivious the American public is to what is going on out there. You know, I'm former military, and I'm also retired law enforcement. I've personally done deployments to the Caribbean and to Africa, sometimes armed, sometimes not armed. I was in one country when a major earthquake happened, another country when the Civil War happened. So you've got hundreds of American law enforcement and corrections people out there, as well as the military. And the average American has no clue that this is happening and what's going on.
What does that say to you, Mike? Is it because it's hush-hush, or we just have our eye on other balls, on Afghanistan, Iraq?
Hush-hush. Here's what it comes down to.
Yep.
It's not a matter that it's hush-hush. It's mm-hmm. out there. It's an open secret, so to speak. Everybody knows what we're doing and what's going on if you want to pay attention. But the average American is so caught up in their average American first world lives and first
yep.
world problems that they don't look beyond the borders of their neighborhood, their city, their state, this country. Meanwhile, there's a lot of stuff going on that needs to be going on, not only in Africa, but you've got personnel deployed in Mexico, Central America, the Middle East. Again, military, law enforcement, corrections. We're out there doing what we do. But the average American has no clue because they don't have any reason to bother themselves to know what's going on.
But here we've got a death toll and suddenly people are paying attention. It's become a kind of a political issue as well. But it's good to be aware. These are our men and women of the armed forces, and I appreciate your call, Mike. One more right here, and I'll go to Christopher and Eric. Ryan in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to pose the question, how does what we're doing in Africa right now with training local troops to fight against terrorism and various threats, how does this correlate with some of the things we've done in the past, be it training Ho Chi Minh and his followers, the Mujahideen back in the 80s, maybe even the 70s, just various groups in the past who we've trained and then they have turned against us and we are drawn into a war that lasts, you know, more time than we ever want it to last.
Afghanistan, Vietnam, of course, a lot of South Vietnamese trained in Vietnam who fought troops loyal to Ho Chi Minh at that time. Eric Schmidt, do you see the potential here for a bigger conflict, or are we in some kind of age of simmering threats all over that require the kind of deployments our callers are talking about all over the place?
Well, let's be clear. These countries have asked for U.S. assistance, at least the countries I visit, and I've visited most of these in West Africa just in the last few years, Mali, Chad, Senegal, Mauritania. They welcome the U.S. presence there. They welcome the U.S. technology and equipment because their countries, their societies are under attack in many cases here. So, and the U.S. is not going in with large numbers of forces again. Yes, the 800 number is maybe
head
a little
turning.
Bit of an anomaly
mm-hmm.
in Niger, but largely that's because they're either building this second drone base in Agadez or they're operating there. We're not seeing large numbers of troops out in the field, for instance. So I think in this case, you know, you're looking at a situation where the special forces, and they're largely special forces that are out on these kind of missions, They're older, more mature troops. This is what they do. They speak various languages. They're meant to connect with the indigenous forces on the ground, help them improve so that the U.S. doesn't have to send large numbers of forces and alienate the local populations. We're not talking about an Afghanistan or Iraq-style deployment.
But it's important for Americans, if we're going to be deploying, and deploying in such a widespread way, to be aware as citizens of what the military is doing. And it's very widespread footprint here in North Africa, in Niger in particular this time, and four Green Berets dead there. Christopher Chivas with the RAND Corporation's International Security and Defense Policy Center. Thank you very much for being with us today, Christopher.
Thank you, Tom.
And Eric Schmidt of the New York Times. Terrific to have you filling us in on Niger. Thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you, Tom.
I want to turn to how the president has spoken about these deaths in Niger and the political uproar that has followed from that. To help us do that, David Graham joins us right now from Durham, North Carolina. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. David Graham, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And from Nashville, Tennessee, presidential historian, Pulitzer Prize winner John Meacham is here, author of Thomas Jefferson, American Lion, about Andrew Jackson, Destiny and Power, about George H.W. Bush. John Meacham in Nashville, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Can we just listen for a moment to the comments that President Trump made? This was this Monday, 12 days after that ambush in Niger. He was asked why he hadn't contacted he was asked about this, and it came out why he hadn't contacted families of the four dead Green Berets. He said he was planning to reach out, and then he compared himself favorably, but inaccurately, we're told, to past presidents. Here was President Trump.
The traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it. They have made the ultimate sacrifice. So generally, I would say that I like to call. I'm going to be calling them. I want a little time to pass. I'm going to be calling them.
And boy, did an uproar follow that. David Graham, first, was it something strange that the president of the United States had not spoken of these four deaths during these 12 days, or is that fairly typical? And then what about this as his first response to questioning and first public comment?
I think it is a little unusual. And, you know, we have some sense, you know, from your guests before, there are a lot of questions about this that we don't yet understand. Mm-hmm. But it was strange for the president to be silent for almost 2 weeks. And as Eric Schmidt mentioned, you know, the National Security Council drew up this fairly anodyne statement. It's also a little weird the way the president took the question. You know, the answer could have been a fairly straightforward, you know, we grieve for American soldiers. This is an important part of our role in the world. And instead, he took it in this very personal way. You know, why there was no specific question about him reaching out to the families. And he takes it in this very defensive and, I think, personal way, which is unusual.
John, you've looked at presidents over a lot of time. What about President Trump's comments here, not only on the deaths and what he would do and when he would do it and what it seemed had not done at that point, but bringing other presidents and comparing his behavior to theirs into his first comments on these soldiers' deaths?
Well, David just used a very important phrase for the age in which we live, which was that the president took it in a very personal way. My only amendment to that would be that's kind of redundant because he takes everything in a personal way. What I think happened here is he had probably been briefed on the fact that previous presidents, by and large, have not only written to the families of the fallen, but have called them, have visited on occasion, certainly visited the wounded. Some have gone to Dover. They have often actually not publicized that, believing, I think, to borrow a transatlantic image, Walter Badgett wrote about the English Constitution, which is that there was both a dignified and an efficient part of government. And the dignified part of government, at least since Vietnam, the commanders in chief have tended to be more private than public in their actual consolation of the families. President Reagan at Camp Lejeune in 1983, after the terrible Marine bombing of the barracks in Beirut, was remarkably effective with the families in a given place. George H.W. Bush was extremely emotional with families when he was with them, largely in private. President Clinton the same way, President George W. Bush the same way, President Obama the same way. One of the ironies here is that because of the sheer volume of combat deaths in a time of large-scale war, the president has a hard time executing that function on an individual basis.
And that would have been more true under George W. Bush and even Obama than under President Trump so far. Just 43 deaths, I think, in his time.
Exactly. And so, again, one of the tragedies is that if we are in a large-scale war, the president is more overwhelmed in order to be able to do that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking this hour about what happened in Niger that left four American Green Berets dead, and how the president has handled those deaths, how other presidents have done that hard work. John Meacham, presidential historian, Pulitzer Prize winner, is with us from Nashville, Tennessee. David Graham is here, staff writer for The Atlantic. He's been reporting on the deaths of those Green Berets and the president's response. You can link to his work at our website, onpointradio.org. It has been quite the trail of sound on this. The president first saying, well, you know, the other presidents didn't call, but I call. By Tuesday, he was backing off a little on that. Here he was on Fox News Radio on Tuesday.
I really speak for myself. I'm not speaking for other people. I don't know what Bush did. I don't know what Obama did. You could find out easily what President Obama did. All you have to do is ask the military people. But I believe his policy was somewhat different than my policy. I can tell you my policy is I've called every one of them.
And then things got more gnarly. There was this case of the president who did call. The widow, turns out not pregnant widow, of LaDavid T. Johnson. This is the last Green Beret whose death at first was unknown, but later moved the death toll from 3 to 4 there in Niger. And it happened that she was in a car, and Florida Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson was also in that car with Maisha Johnson when she got the president's call. And then here was how the congresswoman described what she heard President Trump telling Maisha.
He said, well, I guess you knew something to the fact that he knew what he was getting into when he signed up, but I guess it hurts anyway. You know, just matter-of-factly that this is what happens. Anyone who is signing up for military duty is signing up to die, and that's the way we interpreted it, and it was horrible.
The call on speakerphone, I guess, obviously. The next day, President Trump denied that he had said that.
I did not say what she said, and I'd like her to make the statement again because I did not say what she said. I had a very nice conversation with the woman, with the wife, who sounded like a lovely woman, did not say what the congresswoman said, and most people aren't too surprised to hear that.
What's the proof, Mr. President?
Let her make her statement again, and then you'll find out.
That you said this.
Okay, let her make her statement again, and then you'll find out.
And then you've got reporters all over this, the Associated Press, trying to call around to all of the 43 families of those who have lost service members while President Trump has been in office to ask them if indeed he's called all of them. 9 said that he had, that they got a hold of. 9 said that he had not. Here you had Whitney Hunter yesterday, another Gold Star widow, lost her husband in an attack in August in Afghanistan. Yesterday, CNN interviewed her. She said she was glad that Vice President Pence had been there at Dover Airport when her husband's remains were returned, but she had been told the president would also call, and she said she never heard from President Trump.
I knew that Jonathan's sacrifice was appreciated, and I knew that the condolences were sent out to me, so it was very genuine. But my issue is having all of the support I had was great. But not receiving the phone call, I don't like that I was told that I would receive the phone call, but then I never did.
I'm not sure where to dive in here. John Meacham, can we go first to just the record? Because the thing that got people's attention in the first place was, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. And then he said that he calls everybody. Now, first of all, did past presidents make calls to families of the soldiers who had died, John?
Absolutely. The president's claims are false. Did presidents call every service family? No. But what is this a hallmark of recent post-Vietnam presidential behavior? Absolutely.
David, what about the president's claim then that he calls all of them? The AP's reporting would seem to indicate that that is not the case.
That's right. And the Washington Post had another story that found the same thing. You know, it's a weird case of Trump making an unforced error. And we've seen this before. No one would have been looking into whether he made all these phone calls until he made this outlandish claim. And he, you know, attacked the integrity of his predecessors. That drives people to start looking. And of course, they find that Trump is stretching the truth and isn't really telling the truth about what he did in these cases. So it's a strange example of him calling attention and creating a self-inflicted crisis.
Is there something – John, you're saying it's a falsehood that he put at the feet of previous presidents. I guess that's not what we expect from presidents, certainly talking about their predecessors or talking about military deaths. Why do you think this president would do that? Why compare his activity in a way that turns out to be false to previous presidents?
Well, usually it requires a 50-minute hour with a psychiatrist to answer that question. Honestly, I think, and David used the phrase unforced error. I think that's right. But this entire presidency is a series of both forced and unforced errors. We have a president who has very little to no historical conception of the office, whose capacity for empathy is vanishingly small, and who has a remarkable narcissistic tendency to not only make everything about him, but is driven by a mindless competitiveness with both Secretary Clinton, President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton. He probably doesn't know presidents back much farther than that.
Yeah.
So I think that we are living in this mindlessly Darwinian moment where the president is his default setting, his primary setting, is to fight these kind of tabloid wars when he was in New York. And when you're in New York and you're fighting over your divorce or a real estate deal, that's one thing. But he's brought the same instincts for perpetual competitiveness to the presidency, and now it matters.
And he was willing to bring his chief of staff, General John Kelly, into it. Of course, General Kelly lost his son, Marine Second Lieutenant Robert Kelly, in Afghanistan in 2010. He has avoided discussing his loss publicly. There he was, as Trump said this.
You could ask General Kelly, did he get a call from Obama? You could ask other people. I don't know what Obama's policy was. I write letters, and I also call.
But now we have the Associated Press calling all of these families. And here we've got the family of Aaron Butler. This was a 27-year-old guardsman from Monticello, Utah, killed in August in Nangarhar province in Afghanistan. His mother and family spokesman saying that the president has not called or sent a letter. Army Specialist Christopher Michael Harris, 25, Jackson Springs, North Carolina, killed in Afghanistan in August. The White House offered to set up a call, but it fell through. His family said his widow, Brittany Harris, look, presidents have a lot to do, but they don't usually get into tangles over how they do it better than others, or in this case, exactly what they do that maybe they didn't. Brittany in Clarksville, Tennessee. Brittany, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just want to make a point that instead of politicizing the two sides that he said, she said, what we need to be doing is focusing on these heroes, their records, what they've done for our country. And I just feel so sorry for the families having to deal with, well, did you get a phone call? Did you get a letter? Let's focus on the sacrifices that these families have made for our country. And I just have such a hard time listening to how he speaks and to our service member, you know, to the country, as far as he can't empathize with or relate to what we go through. And, you know, it's a problem with him not understanding what it means to serve. And we shouldn't be shocked or surprised by what he says, because this is not something new, and it's not something that we haven't heard from him before.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there for these conversations, but of course the congresswoman was, and the widow in Florida was, from La David Johnson, and she's spoken unhappily about it. You're right. The number one thing here, pretty clear, should be to honor those who have lost their lives. Other presidents certainly have done that. This was just one example among many. President Obama, 2009, made a middle-of-the-night trip to Dover Air Force Base to be there for the return of the remains of fallen U.S. soldiers, later told the Associated Press what impact that visit had on him.
It was a sobering reminder of the extraordinary sacrifices that our young men and women in uniform are engaging in every single day.
And we've seen that video of President Obama standing there in the dark, wind just whipping the legs of his trousers as those coffins came off the plane. That scene we know too well. Here's former President George W. Bush. This was 2007 at an event on funding legislation for the Iraq War. But he was joined there by W. Bush, by a Gold Star mom.
We owe it to our men and women in uniform to give them the full support. It's important as people debate this issue to think about somebody like Mary Lee Carlson with us today. She's a Gold Star mom. 2 years ago, Mary Lee's son Michael gave his life in Iraq when his platoon was on a night mission to take out two terrorist bomb-making factories.
George W. Bush, president, and we've heard in the days since President Trump's remarks from families who lost service members under Bush. One woman who was saying that when she saw the president, she just yelled at him in her grief and rage, and that President Bush just absorbed it and just continued to comfort her there. And now we have another occupant in the White House, David in Greenville, South Carolina. David, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi. So, you know, one of the things that I've been hearing from the panel and I've heard, you know, broadly in the media since the congressman from Florida came out was criticism on Trump's behalf of him being insensitive and you know, lack of empathy and what he said. But, you know, the thing is that wouldn't that criticism cut both ways in the sense, since the congresswoman, privy to a private conversation between the president and the grieving widow, her first impulse was to go and do hits on television shows and news programs politicizing the issue. So I'm fairly confident that this criticism cuts both ways here. And to respond to one thing John Meacham said, I think that an argument could be made that most presidents are narcissistic in many ways. I'll take the answer off the air, guys. Thanks, Tom.
I appreciate your call, David. John Meacham, most presidents are narcissistic, so get over it.
Well, most people are. Yeah, it's true. But I think there's a level of how corrosive is it? How does it affect the actual public execution of the duty? And the public execution of the duty is how does it affect the overall well-being of the republic? And that sounds very grand, but that is actually the question. The development of the American presidency really from the very beginning. It was not supposed to be as primary an office. It was not supposed to hold as privileged a place in the system when the framers were at work. But almost immediately it began to be that under Washington, guided in many ways by Alexander Hamilton. Even Thomas Jefferson, who was a strict constructionist, became a loose constructionist. He was against executive power until he had it, which goes to the narcissistic point. It matters because we're not looking for a perfect person to be in the White House. If so, the job would go unfilled. But I think that, and this is not a partisan political point, this is to my mind, a clinical historical one, that this president is two things. One is he is culturally ubiquitous in a way that no other president, to my mind, has ever been. And secondly, he thrives on manufactured conflict. So to go to the caller's point, I agree that the fact that we're discussing the details of a private conversation is not ideal. But we wouldn't be if the president had not decided to make himself look better as opposed to his predecessors and threw down this gauntlet. So to some extent, to whom much is given, much is expected, he's the president of the United States, and we have a right to expect a higher standard of behavior.
David Graham,
wrong of the congresswoman in Florida to communicate what she says she heard the president say to that widow? He knew what he signed up for? Wrong?
Well, you know, you saw the White House in the press briefing yesterday accusing her of politicizing the issue, which feels either very ironic or very disingenuous. You know, I think John is right. It's not ideal to have this going on. You know, Trump is went out of his way to make this a political issue, though. And I think in this we kind of see the unrelenting centrifugal force of Trump as president. He turns the conversation in a different direction toward this question of what he personally did, and it sets a little bit of a trap for the discourse. Because on the one hand, if you ignore the things Trump says and allow him to pass these falsehoods, they become reinforced, even if it's done in the name of keeping your eye on the ball. If, on the other hand, you follow the things he says and work to figure out whether they're true or not, suddenly we end down this rabbit hole and we're in a political fight about, you know, how well the president consoles Gold Star families and whether or not he's lying about it. So it's a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't situation for the press and for the public.
You know, is it too much to expect a president to call every family? There are times, John, when, you know, there have been many thousands of deaths under particular presidents. Is this a sort of social media age expectation?
I think it's a great question. I think it's a sign of how remote, to some extent, for so many people, the actual realities of military service have become. It is a tiny percentage of the country that is directly affected by bonds of blood and affection for military sacrifice. And I think that in an interesting way, that magnifies the need. We've become, as the, you know, the end of the draft, the end of the selective service, the military is not as much of a class mixing, racially mixing institution as it once was, and so it is a almost a separate world. And I think that there are expectations for the relationship of the commander in chief to that incredibly important part of our society. I will say this: one of the things that, and very rarely in the age of Trump can you take X and then get to Y, but fundamentally, this is also a question about what will he do in terms of projecting power, in terms of putting other soldiers' lives at risk as he balances our interests and continues to govern. So this is not simply ceremonial. It is substantive. And this gives us a window into how he thinks.
John Meacham, we're out of time right there, and I'm sorry for it, but John Meacham, presidential historian, Pulitzer Prize winner, David Graham with The Atlantic. We're grateful to both of you for being with us in this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks, John. Thanks, David. This is On Point.